This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This weekend on the podcast, I have an extra special guest returning to the show, Jack Devine, 32-year veteran of the CIA. His resume is just too long to go over. We talk about a lot of it. He was instrumental in pushing the Russians out of Afghanistan in the 1980s. He helped run the counter-narcotics division for the CIA. He's just had so many roles within the intelligence world. Really quite an astonishing career. His new book is all about Russia's aggression against the West, not in the Cold War era, but today. And it's quite fascinating and very revealing, in particular, how the Russians have so skillfully used social media to foment unrest and anger and essentially turn Americans against each other. They're not the only reason why the country is having issues, but they are clearly pouring fuel on the fire. It's quite fascinating. Really, a person with an endless amount of insight and knowledge from a unique position. With no further ado, my conversation with the CIA's Jack Devine.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, I have an extra special guest. His name is Jack Devine. He is a 32-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, where he has served as acting director and associate director of operations. He was the chief of the Latin American division and head of Counter-Narcotics Center, where he was awarded the CIA's Meritorious Officer Award and Distinguished Intelligence Medal. He has written a number of books on the intelligence fields. His most recent, Spy Master's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. He was chief of the Afghan Task Force and in 1986-87 helped drive the Stinger anti-aircraft program, the handheld missile that took out Russian helicopters and really changed the course of the war, sending the Russians fleeing from Afghanistan. It couldn't be more timely given our recent withdrawal. Jack Devine, welcome back to Bloomberg.
Great to be back, Barry.
So let's start a little bit with your background, but I guess I really have to lead with Afghanistan. Tell us a little bit about your perspective as to what's going on in that nation and where the United States went wrong, other than the fact that we were there for two full decades.
Well, I think it all starts, it's like many things. How do you get into something in the first place often determines how you get out years later. So I think we all were quite shaken, and that's an understatement, by the attack against the Twin Towers in New York and the Pentagon and when Al-Qaeda attacked. And this country, our beloved country, everybody wanted to get the people responsible immediately and go get bin Laden. And we knew he was in Afghanistan. So naturally, there was a program. The U.S. government immediately decided we were going to go get him. And within hours, the CIA had a team on the ground, already had on the ground, but a team coming in to work with some of the Mujahideen leaders in the Northern Alliance, which I had worked with years earlier. And the special forces were coming in right behind them. They would have been there at the same time, but as I understand it, the paperwork got tied up, but the special forces wanted to be there. And they did a magnificent job. And actually, 9/11 took place, but the government fell. The Taliban government fell. People forgot this in November, I think November 7th. So, that early covert action program. Now, bombing, the very first thing was bombing in October. So, and the reason I mention this is, we basically had them brought down, and our overt military arrived on night the 19th of October. The government fell, a few days later. So did we really need an army is the question. I wrote an op-ed piece that's still floating around today in July of 2010, the CIA solution, which is let's not put We're not going to win with an army on the ground. We should be working to get bin Laden, and then where our interests apply, we're covertly. So I think the big judgment call was that we needed to put our army on the ground. Once we made that decision, then there was no question that we could drive them off the field, and we did. The question is, how do you get out? And, you know, the thought that we would be there 20 years later was probably not on anybody's mind. So fast forward, we got up to 100,000 troops during the Obama administration, and then, you know, started to bring it down. And, you know, there's a big argument. The big argument today is it's not a big argument. I think the vast majority of people in the United States think it's time to leave. But I think what we were looking at isn't so much that we were leaving. The last few days, I think the really criticism is on how did we manage, you know, the exit and could have been avoided. I think we're going to have a tremendous number of congressional inquiries and so on about this, and this will be a lingering issue. So I don't think it's about, was it time to get out? I mean, I've been saying this for a long time. It's, you know, how do you get out? And being careful not to get into things where we put troops on the ground, because that is a longer commitment. And I'm an advocate for using covert, and my whole career was devoted to covert action.
I am a believer that even with troops on the ground, if we would have remained focused on Afghanistan and come up with a plan to do what we have to do and then get out of that country, it could have been a much cheaper, shorter, more effective war. How accurate is it to say that the adventure in Iraq, and I use those words purposefully, a war of choice that had nothing to do with 9/11, that distracted us from the task at hand in Afghanistan, is part of the factors that led to this snafu that we see currently going on today?
I think historians, when they go back, because you need to get away from it. Everyone's over, you know, committed. They had a role, so they're defending their role. But I think when history looks back, we're going to have a hard time explaining exactly why we went into Iraq, because they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, right? And there was nothing, even if they had them, there was nothing indicating that it was going to be used against the United States. And the proof of the pudding became they didn't have them, so they certainly wasn't an imminent threat. So I think there were a lot of us at that time that scratched our head about why we're going to Iraq. Iraq has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. So, you know, and this is, I'm not a Johnny-come-lately on this. I was stumped at the time. And I go into that in both of my books, you know, I think it was one of the great errors in our foreign policy and use of our tremendous force. I mean, so, you know, we spent a lot of time and money and most importantly, our precious military personnel. So I think it was a great distraction. We missed the main point, which was go get bin Laden. Or another op-ed where I was very critical of our government for not getting him. You know, we took years to find him. He was in Pakistan, so invading, you know, Afghanistan, you know, when the guy was in Pakistan, is, you know, again, historians will look back and scratch their head. Huh. However, I was 100% for going after him and going into Afghanistan, but as I said, covertly. But the Iraq wars, one thing that I've learned over the years in the CIA, are all-consuming. In other words, once you decide you're going to commit to a war, almost all your other activities, and particularly in the national security arena, are all driven by that war. You stop looking at less about Russia and less about China. In other words, it becomes all-consuming. All of your personnel, they're hired against that mission. So it alters, you know, institutions. It is the wars, you know, when they drag on, they have tremendous change. It has tremendous change about your national security structure, and there's a long tail to it, paying for it. That trillions of dollars are going to be paid for by our grandkids. So, you know, I think history is going to be really hard on decision to go in and to have stayed as long as we did. And, you know, there was universal support, so there's no way they can blame it on Republicans, the Democrats, the press, and you and I had a brief exchange. I mean, you know, there weren't a lot of people shouting about going into Iraq at the time, and I just found it really dumbfounding. that we went in.
Post 9/11, I think you could have invaded anywhere and would have gotten support, and that's been some of the criticism of the Bush-Cheney administration. But let me circle back to the point you just made about wars being all-consuming and leading us to take our eye off of other balls that are in the air. Clearly, the focus has been on the Middle East for the past 20 years, since 9/11. But in Spymaster's Prism, the fight against Russian aggression, you make a very cogent case that Russia remains a dangerous adversary, that they weren't distracted by what was going on in the Middle East, and that they very capably built up assets against the United States, which they have been deploying quite successfully without a whole lot of counter from us. Tell us about the motivations that led you to write this new book.
Well, there's a couple of really key questions in your point. Let me tackle them. I mean, the first one is, you know, it's not that I'm, you know, using Kentucky Windy trying to figure out what happened in terms of our attention. I mean, very clearly in our public records, the budget against, you know, the Soviet Union, if you will, as opposed to Russia, dropped from, you know, 70% in the whole war down to 10%. Now they're building it back. And in the first book, Good Hunting, I mentioned sort of at the end, not mention, I go into some lens, that terrorism is going to be with us. And in fact, it's been with us since the beginning of time, but it spikes. And it spiked the 9/11 and ISIS, and we had to do what we had to do. But the real or bigger arching, overarching, longer issues will be the return of competition among nation states. And that's where we are. The dialogue is about China, Korea, Russia, Iran. So that's where the new national security emphasis. You can't take your eye off of terrorism, but there was a clear trend. But we were all in. I mean, when you put an army on the ground and you get up to 100,000 troops and, 100,000 contractors and billions of dollars, so much effort goes into that that the government isn't fungible in the sense that, you know, you're going to have to take people off of something to cover it, and you have to hire new people. So I think we became, you know, we felt that the big targets were not going to be the competitors that there are today. China clearly has loomed large. That should not have been a surprise. But your point, which is, I think, a really good one, is we sort of had benign neglect, if I could use that old phrase, about Russia. It was somehow wasn't the Soviet Union. So, and it wasn't, didn't have the economy of China. It has the economy of Spain or Italy. We should worry less about it. But no one stood back and said, well, who's actually working against us and our national security? In other words, who's actually operating against us, and particularly the United States? And this is what drove me to the book. And that is, when I saw the elections in 2016, I was, again, flabbergasted that not that the Russians were in collecting information in cyber. I mean, that's been going on and will continue to go on and go on for as far as I can see. What they did that was really different, a seismic change, which I couldn't believe they did, which is they took the information and used it politically inside the United States. And that is not what happened in the Cold War, as I go into the book. There is, we fought each other all around the world, but we did not run big, sophisticated covert action operations inside Russia after Stalin. And they weren't, there were a few blips on the screen, but just as a general principle understanding, they were not operating in the United States in our political system. So 2016 isn't so much that they were collecting the intelligence, that they were in there. And that's what drove me up the wall. I wanted to scream from the rooftops and pay attention. The Russians are deep into our cyber world, the new world of combat, and they're very effective. They've been doing this, and they've been penetrating us for longer than the Chinese, and we can get to that. But they're using it, and we need to respond to that. So that is the, you know, clarion call, if you will, from on the Spymaster's Prism.
Let's talk a little bit about the competition between the United States and Russia. The U.S. is an open society. We have a free press, a robust constitution, a First Amendment that guarantees freedom of the press. Does this put us at a competitive disadvantage against those nations that would take advantage of our freedoms and openness?
It's a double-edged sword. And I will take the open, free, democratic side of the sword in the sense that if, during the Cold War, and, you know, we talk about the spying business, having that as our mantra brought many of the best agents to us, the best supporters, the world to help us, our allies to help us. Was that flag flying high? How would you like to have been a Russian KGB guy selling the economy in 1980, right? I mean, we had a clear advantage. It's a tough sell, right? We're talking to a lot of people in business. Try and sell that. So it's a great advantage. However, there is the other side of the coin, which is if you want to, we have a system that looks broken in some ways on this next coin. We need to get a consensus. In authoritarian governments, you don't need a consensus, right? You can move more quickly. The Chinese can move quickly. The Russians can, the Iranians, because they don't have to have, you know, Congress and so on. But I want to stick with Congress despite my misgivings about some parts of it. But my point is, when you get into the cyber type of world, our openness provides a level of vulnerabilities that in warfare gives them an edge. And I should add just one point there, not to get pessimistic. I think we're very powerful in our capabilities in the cyber war. The big issue is, because we're a democracy, going to your point, Barry, in order to use it against an adversary, we need to get a consensus. We need to get Congress to approve it. The president can't do that unilaterally because it is action. It's covert action, and they'd have to get approval. So today's world, being a democracy, you have to go through that process. And what you're looking at in 2016 and before that and after that, they do not have the same compunctions and constraints. So they have an edge. But I still want to stick with our system because at some point the system will come together. I know that seems Pollyannish in this moment, but we'll come together and we will get a consensus on what we need to do in the cyber warfare. But we don't have it now. And it is we're at a disadvantage and a weakness now, which goes to your, I think, very perceptive question.
Tell us about Moscow rules. What are they? And when did they start changing?
So when I looked at the election, as we were just talking, our 2016 election, and you know, I was hearing that the KGB was actually interfering in our political process. I was in denial at first. I thought they can't do that. That's politically stupid. But now I'll come back and say maybe it wasn't so stupid after all on their part. The second part was that's not how we played the Cold War. Didn't somebody brief Putin? Putin was actually in the Cold War. He was in Dresden, and we can talk about that at some point. What were the rules? You can't find them. It's like the Magna Carta. You know, it's a little hard to get your hands around the exact document. But there was an understanding that there were certain things that weren't going to happen early on in the Cold War. We were not going to counterfeit each other's money. Why? We would destroy the world economy. So we both had the capability to do it. That never happened. You know, we wouldn't rough up each other's officers because we were fighting all around the world, and we would have no chaos in the intelligence world. So, but there are a few exceptions on that. But by and large, that was an understanding. The other understanding was, you know, we can run operations around the world against each other, Afghanistan, you know, Chile, Egypt, wherever the crisis was, Italy after the war. But we were not going to meddle in each country's programs. And I was in charge of it, as you know, for a period of time, number two, and then acting for number one, as number one. And, you know, I would just tell you, the idea of someone came up and said, look, let's run a cute operation in Russia. Look, that's not how we play this game. And so the Moscow rules, we need to get back to the table. And I'll tell you, it's not just the election. The election is just the manifestation of the problem. And that is, how are we going to conduct cyber warfare? We can have treaties on missiles and boundaries and treaties on management of water and so on. But how do you manage cyber when it's invisible? So you have to have, and that comes hard to a democratic system. In other words, we like things out in the open. We came very slowly the intelligence business through history. We built up intelligence and backed away. So how are we going to deal with cyber? And the truth of the matter is, in my estimation, and I hope it was, that was hopeful that I was hearing something in the first discussions with Putin, that they were going to defer to the second level officials to sort of work out things. I was hoping, and I don't know that to be the case, that there'd be some understanding among the intelligence groups at a very high level. This is not a committee. This is really one or two people agreeing that we know what you're doing, you know what we're doing. Let's understand each other. We're going to stay out of each other's political system. And if they don't, then you get to the really hard nub, and this is where we need a consensus in this country. How do we respond to that aggressive Russian aggression inside of our political and economic system?
So what is – there obviously was a willful calculus made by Vladimir Putin to violate these rules. Did he just see us as sort of distracted and vulnerable and thought, let me go mess with them? What's behind such a radical change in the relationship between two very powerful nations?
I think it goes to the personality of Putin, and it goes to a strategic decision. On the personality, as I said, he wanted to be a KGB officer. At 17, they turned him down, but he actually got into KGB. You have to be, it was hard to get into the KGB, just like it's very hard to get into the CIA. I'm an exception, but we set that aside. But so he knew what he wanted to become. He wanted to defend, the system. He was a true believer. And they didn't send him to Paris to wine and dine the French or to Washington and hang out in Georgetown. No, they sent him to Dresden. And Dresden is, the bleak, dark East Germany that, the famous Marcus Wolf, the real Carla of Le Carré's books. I mean, he had more spies, Marcus Wolf, than I think any nation state had at the time. So he was in the dark side of the Cold War. And when the Soviet Union fell, he was crushed, his whole world. And I think he was committed. And he remains this, and people need to understand that he is committed to the reconstitution of the Great Russia. Not so much the Communist Party, but Russia being powerful and its intelligence arms being powerful. And guess what? And its enemy being the United States. And I have a hard time coming to terms with it, but when I look at the psychology, he grew up in a world where the number one enemy of the KGB was the U.S., and that's still there. He has in mind that we're an implacable enemy. And the truth of that, his adversaries like myself, I think we ought to have a good relationship with Russia. There's an awful lot of similarities with Russia and its role in Europe, and we shouldn't be adversaries. So it's on that psychological level. And then we can go into the whole psychology of Putin, if you like. But I think he actually believes that we're an adversary in a way that I don't believe is the case. The second thing is they've developed a strategy, a military strategy, and it's attributed to one of their generals, Rozyntsov, it's pronounced right, and he was the head of the armed forces, and he later said, well, that's not really his strategy. It's called a hybrid strategy. It means when you're facing adversaries, you use military, economic, political, but cyber. In other words, they have made cyber part of their military strategy and the use of it and the use of disinformation. In other words, what you saw in the United States is only the visible, you eventually saw a visible part of a military strategy, and that is you weaken your adversary, or if you'd like something softer, competitor, by getting into their system, into their cyber world, and causing trouble and making them a weaker political force. And I think it was both politically, not politically, psychologically driven, but I think it was part of their strategy. If there's an opportunity to weaken us, they will. And I refer to them dabbling in Venezuela. They're trying to do what they did in the Cold War, challenges everywhere. The one to keep your eye on today, not necessarily next year, but today, is if you're looking at, look at today, what was Russia's role with the Taliban? What are they going to be doing And what do they want done? And I absolutely promise you, their objective in the Taliban, one, was to make life miserable for the U.S. and to use whatever capabilities it had. And I think that story will unfold. So we need to recognize, yes, China's a big, tremendous military force. But Russia is fighting above its weight, but it's actually punching us. China's in training, really doing vigorous training.
One of the things you mention in the book is that Putin is essentially the newest czar in a long line of czars. How did you come to that conclusion? Is it a function of his net worth, which I've seen all sorts of crazy numbers about, or just his consolidation of power and really being the Russian autocrat?
I think, first of all, the counterintelligence people in CIA are going to get excited if I say this, but I think he's a very talented guy, really smart, cunning, politically sensitive. This is a worthy adversary. So what happened, if you look, he went into the KGB. The book is called Spy Master's Prison. He was a spy master. He ran spy, and it's a way of looking at the world. And one of the characteristics you strive for is not that you're not emotionally a cold fish, but when you're thinking, you have to look at the realities of the situation, and just whether you like them or not, you've got to deal with them. So I think he's a realist, and what his objective is to make, to consolidate power. How do you become strong? Powerful, right? So he maybe didn't set out to be the czar, but he left and he got involved with the politics in Petersburg, became the something more elegant than Bagman, but he had a lot of interaction with in the political process. But then he ended up being the head of their version of the FBI. People forget he was the head of the FSB. That's their FBI. What does that do? That runs spies, intelligence, hard-edged information. Tough guy. You don't get there by accident, let me tell you, in Russia. So, and then the political process put him around the Yeltsin circle. And people have forgotten. So the oligarchs, the old timers thought, well, let's bring Putin in. He can be the successor to Yeltsin because we can all manage him, right? We can all manage him. What they missed was they had someone that was twice as cunning as they were and quickly consolidated his position. He was a real political animal of the first order. And so little by little, he consolidated his position, but he was a real operator. And I think we have to understand that and not underestimate him. But we need to understand how he views this. And it's not, the warm embrace where I looked in his eyes and I knew he was telling me the truth. I mean, this is a tough guy.
There's a line in the book that kind of cracked me up, not just that he's a spymaster president, but, quote, there's no such thing as a former KGB agent. Explain that.
That's him. That's what he said. I didn't say that. I would say there's no such thing as a former CIA guy, but that doesn't mean I'm on the payroll. It means that there's a mindset. And what Putin is saying to you is, don't be confused. I know how to run operations. And out of that, I was the head of all operations. So where there is, I think, a major flaw in a guy that I gave, when I would, give to Alexander the Great or something, he might not have been a nice guy, but he knew how to organize. What I would say about Putin, what's wrong with his strategy, is it's the basic principle, which is we're his enemy. I mean, if he put all those political skills into becoming and joining the West and becoming a real partner in the West, I think the Russian economy would be stronger, there more potential would be reached, and the world would be a better place. But I think he's decided he's going to play his hand, and it's better for him to be the tough guy in charge of a smaller Russia, a less dynamic economic Russia, but be in charge. And that when you open up to the West and you open up to the democratic processes associated with it, you can't count on consolidating and holding on to power. So I think he's decided to play the shorthand, which would make him not Alexander the Great or Peter the Great, right? So he is a czar, But on the smaller scale, I do think he's truly a major adversary. In fact, we're confronting today. Leadership is a really important thing, but Xi is not exactly a walk in the park either. I mean, another tough guy, or the Iranians, or the North Koreans, and there was the President of the United States, past and present. We're now, terrorism was a highly decentralized problem. Right now, once the Afghan situation reaches a certain point of stability, which it will, not favorably for us, but stability, we will return to one of the president's biggest challenges. We'll be dealing with hard-minded competitors who have nothing, have very little time for the democratic process as we understand it.
And some of the last Putin question for now, some of the estimates of his net worth, what he snuck out of the country and has hidden elsewhere, puts him amongst the wealthiest five or so people in the world, 80 billion, 100 billion. Are these just sensational numbers with no basis in reality, or has he really moved a lot of Russia's wealth elsewhere as sort of his emergency life raft, or maybe it's his retirement planning?
Well, I think one of the big problems with all autocratic leaders is, you really don't get to enjoy a lot of your retirement money. But I would say this. I don't know where he ranks in terms of the wealth of the top, 100 people in the world, but he is substantially wealthy. I can't think of an example in history where you've held the type of power he held without a large aggrandizement of your fortune. He's certainly not working on what we would call GS pension in the United States, right? It's not the way the world worked, to the best of my knowledge. And then there was this video, wherever they got this video from, if it was Dacia, my God. So I would say he has amassed a fortune. It's not surprising, and it's not unique in history with the people that hold that much power. And whether they can track it down to the penny, I'll leave other experts to go there, but I would say he's substantially wealthy and amongst one of the wealthiest men today.
Quite interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the state of the agency, and in particular, cyber warfare, which seems to be everywhere, from China to North Korea to Iran, and especially in Russia. And let's start with, what is the Internet Research Agency? It sounds like a pretty benign title.
I couldn't help but smile a little bit. The operational director of CIA, its spying group, used to be called the Directorate for Plans. So when you see something like the Internet Research Agency, it has the same ring. It is really an elite hacking group. And it's the centralization of their capabilities. It's a troll farm. I mean, they have the ability to go in and create personas, and they do a really good job of it. It is their platform, one of their principal platforms of executing their cyber program. And again, the GRU and the SVR, that's the military intelligence, the GRU and the old KGB is now called the SVR. So this is really a platform that's used, and it was used during the 2016 election. All of the fake identities and the operational activity that they were involved in emanated from those intelligence agencies, and the IRA played a big part in it.
So let's talk a little bit about the involvement generally in social media, but specifically in the election. What's the purpose of disinformation? What advantage accrues to the Russians if the U.S. is busy sniping at each other over Twitter and Facebook?
Well, I think the big advantage is, I think it's a political advantage. In other words, if you can make people angry with each other in the United States, there's a whole list of organizations that they don't really care whether it's Proud Boys or a QAnon and Antifa, they don't really care about the mission of them. And in some ways, I'm going to tell you, I'm not even sure how much they cared about Trump. The bigger objective was, how do you stir up and make Americans unhappy among themselves, unhappy about the issues, you know, to make any type of special interest group feel that they're being disadvantaged. So it is really psych warfare. It used to be called psychological warfare. And it's used in every battle. I mean, going back, I was just thinking of the Battle of Jericho when you mentioned it, right? You go out there and you blow the horns and make it sound like there's a thousand, you know, thousands of troops when there isn't. I mean, so people align themselves and organize around disinformation. During World War II, the famous body that the Brits put a note on it and floated the body so the Germans would find it and think we were coming in someplace other than Normandy. The Russians in Spymaster's prison, which I thought was particularly interesting, and we know about it because the guy that was involved in it eventually defected to the West. His name is Bittman, the KGB guy. And so in the 60s, that was 1964, all of a sudden, I remember as a young person, which was college at the time, and they found a treasure trove of Nazi documents in Devil Lake, right? And in it, they found all these incriminating documents about German citizens that worked with the Nazis, and, you know, got in the New York Times, and it was a big story, huge story. The only problem with it was a KGB operation, Operation Neptune, right? And what they did is they falsified the documents, and as I said, Bittman himself was part of the team that, you know, organized this, so it looked like it was a private sector discovery. So the purpose was to make Germans hate each other, you know? So disinformation has always been a tool, psychological warfare of the military, but also in the intelligence world. And, you know, substituting Stalin's head and putting someone, I mean, you know, they're just, it goes on and on. The difference today is, when I was in the agency, you know, you only had limited capabilities. As I said, you know, you found the body during World War II and you put a note on it, right? Today, we live in a whole new world. Social media is, you know, like, it's almost like a nuclear weapon, and its ability to generate tremendous force. So the ability to use disinformation, and it's well understood, the Russians have been into disinformation and never stopped, and it's something that they do quite well, actually. And in the modern days, I'm told that the personas they make look very legitimate. They really put time into it. So it's a new way of warfare. So there is a warfare. There's warfare being taking place. And I would submit in Afghanistan today that Russia is using social media to create tensions and problems that are adverse to our interests. So disinformation is part of the big game, so to speak.
So around the time of the 2016 election, we heard the name Cozy Bear. Who or what is Cozy Bear?
Cozy Bear, Fancy Bear, Lady Bear, these are all operational names that, you know, have been given to GRU and SVR entities. Cozy Bear was actually discovered by Dutch intelligence, and it was the Russians actually going in to our system, and the Dutch alerted us to it. They were the first ones to discover Cozy Bear being designed to stir up trouble in the United States during the 2016 election. Again, almost like the operation I mentioned with Bittman, it's called Operation Neptune. So Cozy Bear is really an operational name for an activity. And, you know, when you engaged in sort of meddling inside our country, they got the nickname Cozy Bear, right? So it's the name of an activity rather than a specific group.
And then what took place in 2018? Why was it the GRU probing the U.S. election system?
I think they both are, I can't tell you whether they're coordinated or not. There's probably a bit like our own intelligence world that, you know, a lot of things are coordinated, but some things aren't. But the GRU, and this is true in our own system, you know, big data and the ability to amass big data often requires tremendous computer power. So in our world, you know, NSA has tremendous capabilities in the cyber world, and now we have a military command called Cyber Command. And the reason is because it requires a tremendous amount of firepower, if you will, in the cyber world, and personnel. So, as a consequence, the military is better equipped to handle what I would call large cyber activities. And that's why we have a cyber command today. The CIA, again, this would be, you know, my personal judgment, and the KGB, SBR, probably do more surgical things. In other words, they're not trying to mass all the data and grind it down in supercomputers, but are looking at surgical things, targeted types of activities. So, but both of them are flying under the same flag, which is it is to run operations that weaken the political fabric of the United States.
So let's talk about some of those operations that are attempts to weaken the social fabric here. There's a run of things you've referenced I want to ask you about. You mentioned QAnon. Are the Russians stirring up trouble with that group?
Well, I think there's a number of things that have emerged in the book that it's really what are the types of groups that they would be looking
right.
at? Antifa, right?
Right.
QAnon. They started in the vaccination program, putting out this information about the vaccination, and that vaccination, our vaccinations were not good or not effective, right? So, and then what were the Chinese doing about where did the virus start? And so, Proud Boys, white supremacists, right? Climate. I mean, they're taking issues, and it's not as though, as I said, you don't want to overweight it. They're working with the conservatives or the left or whatever. They are just taking advantages where they see friction inside of our system and try to agitate. So I think, you know, the FBI, I would think, would be immensely busy in trying to figure this out, as well as the NSA. And how deep are they? Now, at the end of the day, I think it's a nuisance at this point. I think what we really need to be concerned is the real potential. If they decided to up the ante, I mean, how far could they push it? And second of all, we need to nip it in the bud. It's not exactly the bud. I think it's blooming, if you will.
Right.
But I think we need to have some understanding. This cannot be go unchecked where, you know, we have, you pick whatever group. In other words, any group that has a voice, and particularly the conspiratorial mindset, and that is much larger than I anticipated. Even though I came from the world of conspiracies, right, maybe it's because I know too much that the conspiracies are harder to bring about than one would think. But there is a mindset in the United States, and I'm only now thinking of where are the roots of this mindset, and it's a conspiratorial one. We've become less sanguine about our government and our institutions, and we're more susceptible than we used to be, and I'm trying to figure what is changing. And then, I mean, it's kind of right before us, right? It's the cyber world. It's social media. In other words, today it is so much easier stir up trouble among people. And I think we have to realize that it's not, a lot of this isn't just internal. Much of it is going to be taken advantage of by all of our competitors. So how to make us weak, and we have to be susceptible. I mean, we have to be perceptive about this, and we have to be able to address it with those doing it. And that's why I think we need to have really tough discussions. The Russians are the ones that are really doing it now. The Chinese looked at 2020. We know this from public intelligence reports that have been made public by the intelligence community, but decided not to in 2020. In other words, they did when Trump was being too tough on them or whatever, but they decided that we can live with that, but we're not going to do what the Russians did. But they looked at it. You know. But the Russians, they're going to go, why step back if you're not being forced to step back? I mean, remember, I start with the view, he's a power player. So a power player looks for vulnerabilities, pushes at it. And you don't back off unless it's power. You're not going to jawbone the Putins of this world or the Xis of this world with sweet words. You know, if you accept that they're a power player, they recognize power. We have to make sure we don't dilute our power. Or one of the things about democracy you touched on, which is really interesting, and we don't think about it enough, America is really restrainful. I know it doesn't feel like that today, but we don't really use our force. The rest of the world looks at us as being much stronger and have a different view of us and our power. We tend not to use our power as much as if our country were an authoritarian-oriented case and didn't have to go before the public. So we're not using our power by choice at this point to counter cyber warfare. And the question is, when will we reach that consensus and the will as united people that we're not going to tolerate, intrusions into our political process?
So let me reference some of the things you write about in the book that was kind of fascinating. I didn't have any idea that the Russians were out buying Facebook accounts and Twitter accounts and other local accounts in order to use that as part of their agitprop. That was really kind of shocking. Who are the useful idiots that are selling these things to the Russians? Because I have to imagine someone wants to buy your Facebook account. No good could ever come out of that.
They create their own personas. I mean, they actually create people that you think that actually exist. In other words, they create identities.
Fake identities and run them on Facebook and Twitter.
Right. Remember, they did that years ago. We had a spy, a famous spy. There was a movie with Tom Hanks 2 years ago. And it was Rudolf Abel, right? He came here under false documents. And they have the show The Americans, right? This is all old Russia stuff. But if you move to today, it's not one person. You're building identities. You're building social media identities that look real. They had, I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think, 2,000, they had like 29,000 Facebook spots that you could hit. They had Twitter accounts. I mean, they were out there. I think the when I did the research on it, I think on the low end concluded that they had like 20 million hits, 29 million hits. It wasn't trivial. It wasn't like one guy came in with a false document, right? We were out there. They were peddling among 29 million people. But I think if you look at the numbers in the aggregate, it looks really big. But I think at the end of the day, the election was really... the American people were voting on bigger issues in their mind than the Russians were working around the edges. But the potential is there. And even if they only changed 2,000 votes or made 2,000 people mad, that's 2,000 too many.
Right. Well, let's look at Brexit, which was, pretty much a dead split down the middle with a slight advantage to the Brexiters. Were the Russians agitating for the UK against the EU, and did they have an impact there?
Yeah, Barry, I don't know the answer, but the Brits are, in some way, they're our closest ally. I would say, we have the Canadians that are close to us. The Australians are the Five Eyes. I think one of the problems for Putin and that issue would be, is it better for Russia to have the UK in or out of NATO? So would the conclusion be they'd be better out? I'm not sure they'd make that call because it might mean closer alliance with the U.S. So I don't know whether I don't have any primary source research on that. But if it felt to them like it was advantageous, then I would suspect that they, and as you were saying, you could work within the margins. But you have to make a decision. And a lot of times, even autocrats are stuck with, tell me how this plays out again. I mean, does it all work to our favor? but they're human beings, and so on a, they can make a snap decision. So I don't think Russia changed and had the impact of on Brexit. So, I mean, I think it's like the American election. I think it is what it is. And I think Brexit ended up for a lot of other overarching issues beyond what the Russians might be able to stir up.
Right. You mentioned in the book after the 2016 election, there were these Not My President rallies. Tell us who was behind those and who was agitating for those.
So, again, you have a lot of folks that in the world of social media, almost spontaneously, you don't know who starts the first tweet on it, right, or whatever. But I think once the Russians saw it, I think our reporting would indicate that they saw that as an opportunity. So that is one area where they were developing Facebook points and agitating. So, but were they the driving force? I won't give them that credit yet.
Right.
All right. But they saw it, and it was in their interest to have a segment of the population feel that the President of the United States is illegitimate. In other words, anytime you're an adversary and you can play that card,
right,
that weakens your adversary. So they surely were into it. Were they the brains behind it? No, I think that was going to come. It did come with or without
regardless.
Them. But would they play in it? Sure. And as I said, you know, around the edges, I'm not saying to make a difference, but they were playing in it. I'm concerned that they're playing across a broad spectrum of things, and the potential, if not checked, then they will create Not My President, right? Now, how much money are they going to throw into it? In other words, it can become really quite disruptive. Now, we could do the same thing inside Russia. I mean, he needs to understand that. But I don't think he believes we're going to do it. Right. I don't think he feels that, you know, we're responding. And I think the last thing our president said was we're going to respond in kind. What does that mean? And Putin's here saying, what's that going to look like? And I think that's why you have to have a private discussion between intelligence people saying, let me tell you what it looks like. So
get ready.
You know, we have to stop. Otherwise, we're going to have, you know, this is like a nuclear weapon. You know, you have mutual destruction, right? So at a certain point, you don't do it, right? You contain yourself. And we don't have that right now. Right now, the Russians feel, you know, we're messing your system. You're not doing much in my system. I don't see any incentive to stop. I'm doing a lot of R&D right now. I'm testing. I don't mean to be so flip about it, but you know, I'm testing this and seeing how we can do this and how we can work within the U.S. system, right? But if, let's say, we really got to the mat and we were, you know, at each other's throat, I mean, we're looking at small potatoes compared to what they could do and what we could do.
What do you think the reaction in Moscow was to the January 6th insurrection that took place earlier this year? Were they surprised by that? Were they agitating by that, or are they just very happy to sit back and say, hey, if you guys are going to fight amongst yourselves, we could just, you know, never get in the way of an enemy shooting themselves in the foot?
I think it's the latter. In other words, it happened so fast. Mm-hmm. It's like the type of thing you can't prepare. But the other thing is, it's one thing to create a persona out there about not my president, right? It's another one to deliberately be involved in a violent act against the capital, right? That's a bit too risky, I think, for even Putin, who is not risk averse. I think you don't want to be caught out on that one. Right. That absolutely requires an American response that's pretty dynamic. So I don't think they had the chance to evaluate it, weigh it. You know, it just happened too fast. But if you're asking me how they feel about it, say, wow, you know, that's one we didn't have to work on, but that really worked out within our plan. It's now, you know, now they're going to have investigations that are going to turn on each other. So, but we're looking at our own weaknesses, and they're sitting there looking at them, and they're thinking about how do you leverage it. Remember, he studied. He's a judo expert. I think he's a black belt, as I recall. He understands how you use the other person's strength against them, right? And So I think, you know, these are judo plays.
That's really interesting. So one of the things you wrote in the book that I found kind of intriguing was, as long as there's an autocratic government in Moscow, there will be people willing to spy for the West. That raises two questions. Why does an autocratic government lead to that? And second, why do Americans and Westerners occasionally spy for Russia? You would think in the battle of good versus evil, it's not crystal clear, but it seems like they've been the bad guy for a long time. Tell us a little bit about why people spy for us and why do people spy for them?
There's a commonality on one level, and don't let me leave you without going there, but let me go to the first set of issues on this. And as I said at the very beginning, working from a democratic system, we had much more of a draw to get people to want to work with us, not just Russians, every group, right? And it was not a hard sell because a lot of people were dissatisfied with their own country because it was a repressive one, light repressive, heavy repressive. But when you have an autocratic government, you have people that are much more disadvantaged and do not have a release for their dissent. The United States has lots of room for dissent. You can say whatever you want, whenever you want. And you can go move on, get another job, and so on. So we have that release, and there are, you know, percentage-wise, fewer people that are alienated. When Russia first started, and the communists started, right, there was an appeal. People believed in communism, right? We have a number of people, both in the UK and the United States, became spies, ideological spies, not for money, but for the cause. But by the time you got to Stalin, I mean, and then World War II broke out, and Hitler and Stalin agreed on how to handle Poland. I mean, that everybody was disillusioned. So it was really hard ideologically after the 50s to, you know, get people to really want to become a communist. So they had a rougher product. But then there's the world. So in the bigger sweep of things, I think democracies have a bigger opportunity and fewer folks that are spy candidates. But there are spy candidates, and I'll get to that. The Russian side, I think a lot of people disgruntled, and they came and volunteered their service. So many of the KGB sources and GRU sources and people like that came to us rather than us finding them. But then what makes people spy gets to another level. So you have the overarching ideological, economic, political, but then you have why is a person betrayed? And what's really interesting when you study the most famous spies, what I found is it's not about ideology. It's, and you take the famous American spy inside of CIA, Rick Ames, or Robert Hansen inside the FBI, and you look at their personalities and you find they share the same thing. They think they're really smart, smarter than everybody else. Sadly for them, they're not smarter than anybody else. But they're also lazy. So when you think you're really smart, you're lazy, and you work inside the U.S. government, you end up getting promoted less frequently, right? And then when you get promoted less frequently, it's the system is against you, right? You're not recognized for the genius that you are. You're not appreciated, right? And you become alienated within your small world. So people often defect inside of that world that they're disgruntled about the squeeze on their ego and their recognition. And, you know, when you look at Ames and you look at Hansen and look at spies, they often have that in trade. So I wouldn't look for someone that's a gambler or drinker. Yes, look for them. But look for the person that has a huge ego and is delusional about themselves and are underperforming. That's where I would go hunting for spies. And they're in every society.
Quite interesting. I wish we had time to get to China, but we'll have to save that for the next time. I have to ask you, before we get to our favorite questions, one last question, another quote from the book, which is, quote, fundamentally, the ultimate lesson to take away is this, never trust the Russians. Explain that.
I was going to name at least the subtitle, Never Trust the Russians. So I had a plaque in my office. I now have it down in my house of the shore. And It's a quote from the last Democratic president in Afghanistan, 1907, Abu Khan, and he talks to his son, and this is the quote, and it says, my son, my last advice to you is never trust the Russians." Now, that plaque was given to me by Charlie Wilson, you know, Charlie Wilson's war, which it wasn't Charlie's war. And I go into the book, it was actually a U.S. government program, but the U.S. government program doesn't make for movies. Like, I don't look like Tom Hanks and things like that, or Charlie Wilson didn't look like it. But my point is it had a sentimental value because it was, if you look at it from the eyes of the Afghanis, and I would say to them today, watch the Russians on your border today. But I don't mean it in the purest sense that never, ever, ever trust them. In this day and age, I would say you need to pay more attention to what they're up to. I honestly believe that somewhere out there, there may be an opportunity to do business with them. And I think the natural course of events would be to bring us together. But I think for today, the mantra is really meant to say, hey, look, pay attention. The Russians are not benign. And so you really can't trust it's standing in front of the in Helsinki and saying, I'm an ex-KGB guy, and therefore I can tell you that, no, we're not spying on you. It's an oxymoron. But so my point is, this is a moment to remember who Russia is. And it's not communism. They're not coming to – they'd be more threatening if they had an ideology. There is no ideology.
So let's jump to our speed round, our favorite five questions we ask all our guests. Starting with, tell us what you're streaming these days. Give us your favorite Netflix or Amazon Prime viewing material.
You know, it's interesting. Let me start with what I don't watch, which I think will surprise your audience. You know, I don't watch Ian James Bond movies, right? I don't watch most Bond movies. I used to resent them because I thought, this isn't the way it is. It trivializes the business. And then I began to realize, geez, if everyone thinks I'm James Bond, they think I'm omnipotent. If you know what I look like, you compare me to Sean Connery, you would know why I'm more favorably disposed towards those seven movies. But I it'll be interesting. I will look at, did look at a couple of the Carrés. The first ones were good. The Spy Who Came In from the Gold. But basically, I really go to another place. I look at Masterpiece Theater, you know, and I'll watch, you know, the Crown or things by Jane Austen. And you say, well, that's kind of light stuff. But, you know, it's such a relief. And you get back to a world where people had manners and personal dignity and so on. So I find those tranquilizing in a most positive sense. So I'm a big fan of the PPS. And I lived in Britain for a substantial amount of time, and I grew to enjoy that and so on. So that's where you'll find me on Prime and Netflix most often. On the podcast, I did an awful lot of podcasts during the promotion of the book, and I enjoy doing them, by the way. But I'm not a follower of a particular podcast. I spend a lot of time going through what I would call the more traditional media outlets. And I probably, if I had more time, I should focus in on podcasts. I enjoyed several of them, but I tend not to be a podcast follower, except my own.
Tell us about some of your early mentors who helped shape your career in the world of intelligence.
One of the great things about writing a book, and we could spend a lot of time on the advantage of writing a book and things that I did not think I would get out of it. One of those is, as a young person, you say, well, I made it by myself, right? That's how I got there. And then you go back, you write a book, you say, well, wait a minute. Start looking at your career. And at every step of the way, and this is a tribute to all of them, that I had a series of bosses, one after the other, but actually put up with me, so, and mentored me and stopped me from stepping on my foot, if you will. And, you know, for my first chief in Chile, and I gotta be careful with the names because some are not and some are. But at every step of the way, the agency seemed to reach out and pull me towards something positive. And I think in retrospect, I ran to things like Chile and Afghanistan. So I was predisposed to sort of the action arm of it. So I owe I easily, in the book, it's very clearly, I describe each of them as sort of putting a helping helping hand is the right word. I don't know how I would have gotten to survive my first assignment without bosses that were interested in being helpful. They called tradecraft the business of spying. And, it's the word craft is really interesting. It's like a journeyman, right? And the best of the best managers in CIA that I worked for looked at it as a trade. Jack, we're going to show you. You know, you went through training, you jumped out of planes, but we're going to show you how it really works. And I'm very grateful. And I admired the generation of people that I worked for that were true patriots. There was one thing they all had in common. They were very diverse people. They were all true patriots and had high integrity. I know that's a hard adjective for people to swallow in the CIA, but you'd be amazed of the dichotomy between the integrity inside the institution and how it exercised power with the approval of the Department of Justice.
Quite interesting. Tell us about some of your favorite books and what you're reading recently.
Well, I think the one I've been enjoying, and I've been going through it slowly, and I actually think it's very apropos. I got so much out of it. It's Ulysses S. Grant by Ron Chernoff. Now, why is it important? You know, you look at the Civil War and everybody, you know, Robert E. Lee, the great general, the, you know, feather in his hat and all this, and you look at this grumpy cigar ashes on his coat, you know, drank too much, Ulysses S. Grant. But when I dug into the book, there was something I didn't realize. He was a quartermaster. In other words, he knew how to make things move. When you looked at the Civil War, so much of war fighting, and this comes to, I want to come to Afghanistan, logistics. I mean, the real heroes of, not Charlie Wilson or Jack Devine or Milt Bearden, but it's the logistics guys, the people that make the mules get where they want to go and the guns where they are and help with the negotiation. In other words, logistics. And Afghanistan, in many ways, and when you go to war, you know, yeah, you need a MacArthur here and there, perhaps, but you really need the logistics guy. And Ulysses S. Grant was the logistics guy. And when you look at his formation, it tells you about how you do things. So when I have time, I spend a lot of time reading newspapers and magazines, and because I'm required to stay up on the world, I tend to go to biographies and history. And I find a lot, you know, Doris Kearns did one on Taft that I read last year, which who thinks about Taft? And when you read it, an amazing career, not going to be president, but, you know, proconsul in the Philippines and on the Supreme Court. I got halfway through one on Polk, and I started on McCulloch's pioneers and who thought of Ohio as being a pioneer state and what it took Americans and the world they lived in. You would think it was one of the formative aspects of our life. And then the one that I've enjoyed is a fun book, because I don't read a lot of fun books, and maybe I should someday. It is a great book that's going to make a movie out of it. It's just taking forever, and it's Boys in the Boat. That is really about the crew team that raced in the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany and what it took to get there. The lumberjacks out of Wisconsin going to that race and inching out a victory. And it's also, you can find it on online. But look it up. Look up 1936 Olympics rowing. I mean, it's America at its best. So I enjoyed it. It was a good read, and I do tend to stick to biographies.
Huh, interesting. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad who was interested in a career in either government service or intelligence?
The sine qua non in this is you really want to be you really have to want to serve your country. And you say, well, that's a cliche. Of course you do. No, you really have to. I mean, you will not get through the door. It's the glue that holds it together. The second thing that I would say is, you know, make sure your education is broad-based. You know, someone's going to say, look, China's the place, learn Chinese. Maybe it won't be. You know, maybe things will happen there by the time you get ready. the broad-based and understanding the history of not only this country, the world, I would invest in that and not worry too much about the specialization and study and read the best books written on it. And certainly please include mine. That's the first, I should have said that's number one. But no, I think it's having a world view. And as I said, really wanting to serve your country is critical. If you want to make a dollar, that may not be the best place.
Huh. Interesting. And our final question, what do you know about the world of intelligence, counterintelligence, spycraft today that you wish you knew 40 years or so ago when you were first getting started?
That's a profound, you know, profound question. I would say that, again, from my perspective, you know, Graham Greene wrote a book, you know, The Human Factor, and that what the essence of the human factor is, the best laid plans of mice and men, right? Whatever you plan, whatever you're doing, you got to double your planning, triple your planning, because something is going to happen that you're not ready for. And, you know, if we look at modern events in Central Asia, you know, having the plumbing in, planning, the importance of planning. The other thing that I would say, and I should have said this almost first, and I found the paucity of it. I thought at every level I went up, I would get to the level where there's strategic thinking, right? And you keep looking for it. And then I found that most of the intelligence world, most of the world is around tactical thinking. What are we going to do today? What are we doing tomorrow? And it's very hard to build into life, you know, the strategic thinking. And of all places, I was at a retreat in the head of the plumbers union. I was 16, came to me and he said, remember three things: firm handshake, never have your picture taken with a drink in your hand, and spend the first 5 minutes before you get out of bed thinking about the bigger aspects of your life. And that's a good, I mean, from a blue collar guy, that's, you know, elite, high level thinking. And I would say for young people, make sure you put time in the strategic thinking and not just how to get from A to B.
Quite interesting. Jack Devine, thank you for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with long-term CIA veteran Jack Devine, author most recently of The Spymaster's Prism, The Fight Against Russian Aggression. If you enjoyed this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of our prior 367 conversations we've had before. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. You can sign up for my daily reads at ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. I would be remiss if I forgot to mention our crack staff that helps put these conversations together each week. Tim Harrow is my audio engineer. Atika Valbrunt is my project manager. Michael Batnick is my director of research. Paris Wald is my producer. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters of Business on Bloomberg Radio.